Welcome, everyone. Thank you for coming. I wanted to give this talk, really, to highlight the kind of relationship between revolutionary socialism and arts and art movements. And we gave this talk deliberately a somewhat provocative title of Abolish the Wages System, Abolish Art, with a kind of subtitle, I suppose, would be an exploration of avant-garde anti-art and anti-capitalism. So the talk will really take three parts. I want to start by defining our terms. So I'm going to define what I mean when I say capitalism. I'm going to talk about what I mean when I say socialism, what the party means when we talk about socialism. And then we'll define art. And then I'm going to have a kind of timeline of anti-art or radical art. And then I'm just going to make some comments on creativity and what it would look like under socialism. With the main proposition on the table being that art, as defined within the terms I'm about to define it, would be abolished under socialism. So let's start by talking about capitalism. So capitalism is a society based on minority control of the means of production. That's to say, the things that we need to survive as human beings, land, factories, transportation, is owned by a minority of people. And the majority of people are forced to sell their labor to the capitalist class in order to survive. It's a society with wage labor on one hand and capital on the other. But behind wage labor and capital are human beings. In other words, wage labor and capital aren't just these kind of abstract forces floating around in the world. Behind wage labor and behind capital constitute human beings. And those human beings make up the two classes that constitute capitalist society. In capitalist society, production is based on profit. In other words, if it's not profitable to produce something, then production doesn't take place. And it's also based on the division of labor. In other words, people are assigned job roles within capitalism. They sell their labor as plumbers or mechanics or factory workers or creative workers. And these job roles are assigned to people. And I think this is kind of an important point to make because it's at the core of what constitutes art within our society. Socialism, on the other hand, is a society based on common ownership. To phrase it in negative terms, it's a moneyless, stateless society, a classless society based on voluntary labor and direct access to goods and services. Production in socialism would be for human need, including the needs of the producers, including the needs of the people that are actually doing the production, and including, of course, the needs of the planet. It can't really be emphasized enough that without a living, breathing planet, human life can't sustain itself. And without access to wild nature, life isn't particularly worth living. And so the production is calculated based on the needs of the people producing, based on the needs of the people consuming, and based on the needs of the natural world. Art, I think it's important to distinguish between art and creativity. So creativity goes back about 36,000 years, 45,000 years. We get the first kind of cave paintings amongst hunter-gatherer people. In Indonesia, 45,000 years ago, the kind of earliest known cave paintings. And creativity is kind of at the core of what it means to be a human being. Marx puts it quite well when he says, "A bee puts to shame many an architect in the construction of her cells, but what distinguishes the worst architect from the best of bees is this, that the architect raises his structure in imagination before he erects it in reality. At the end of every labor process, we get a result that already existed in the imagination of the laborer at its commencement." So the conceptualization of what it is we want to produce is at the core of human productive activity. We imagine something and then we produce it. And this relationship between conceptualizing something and creating something is also at the core of Marx's critique of alienation, because under capitalism, the products of our labor are owned by somebody else. Art is a bourgeois fabrication. And I don't mean this statement as a value judgment. I mean it purely from the lens of the materialist conception of history. art and the idea of an artist came about with the development of the bourgeois mode of production. It's with early capitalism, particularly the Renaissance, that and the rise of the merchant class, that we get the concept of the artist as a distinct type of producer. So prior to capitalist society, there were artisan craftsmen and women, but not artists in the sense that we use the term today. So these craftspeople were usually commissioned by the church for religious art. So it takes the form of medieval sculptures, painting, other items like bestiaries and caskets, and also quite kind of overlooked but cheap things like pilgrim badges and containers of holy water were created primarily for religious purposes. Insofar as there was other forms of art, it was the art that was commissioned by the feudal aristocracy or by the royal family to document their family or their land. Now we'll get into a kind of timeline of anti-art. Now, it's in the nature of these timelines, I think it's important to say that, like, I can't really do justice to the entire history of anti-art. There's going to be plenty of omissions here. And it's somewhat arbitrary as to when we categorize the first anti-art. I've decided to categorize the first instance of anti-art as being the work of Turner. The reason I start with Turner is because I think Turner was one of the first truly provocative artists. There's a performative element to Turner's work, which blurs the line between the painting and the art creation process, and also blurs the line between text and the painting itself. So Turner, I think, in many ways is a precursor to Dadaism, to Fluxus, to Situationism, because he was really one of the first artists who saw art as something that existed outside of the art gallery. Art for Turner and art creation was a matter of going out into the wilderness, particularly the kind of search for the nautical sublime. And the most famous instance of this of Turner's is his 1842 painting, Snowstorm, Steamboat off a harbour's mouth, making signals in shallow water and going by the lead. The author was in this storm on the night the Ariel left Harwich. So Turner, in his title of the artwork, deliberately places himself as within the ship, as somebody who was a part of the kind of the creative process. And this is a kind of seen by most art historians as a slight dig to Turner's critics. So I think it was Ruskin who said, Turner is the painter of fogs, mud and water. And Turner kind of replies to this dig that he was just a painter going out and sort of painting froth in the sea, with a deliberate provocation to say that he was actually on the ship at the time of the creation. One thing that's striking about Turner and about romantic painting in general is that it veers away from the sublime as the religious, specifically in the context of Western art, Christianity. And so the sublime, you know, that is aloft and above us, is emphasized as being a part of nature rather than being the godly, man-made creation. And another quote about the Romantics is that they took God out of the pulpit and put him into the fields and the mountains. So, it's really with the kind of Romantics that we get this first kind of reaction against capitalism, and particularly the capitalist destruction of nature. And the kind of painting illustration of that is Turner's steam train, this kind of colossal force plowing through the natural world. And those of you that are into your poetry, of course, will know of the works of William Blake and his critique of, you know, the kind of the chimney sweeps who are going up, and the kind of the loss of a sort of a kind of innocence and a connection with nature under Victorian capitalism. And I think it's easy to underestimate today just how radical the Romantics were, just how controversial they were. But they were the kind of the first people to really kind of revolutionize art and to push the boundaries of what art could and couldn't be, in particular in this kind of performative manner of Turner. The other person we should talk about, especially here in the Social Park of Great Britain, considering ourselves the political heirs to this tradition is the arts and craft movement, William Morris. So within the arts and craft movement, there's a critique of the demise of creativity within labour under capitalism. There's also a kind of attempt to deconstruct this division between the designer and artist on one hand and the worker carrying out instruction. So the arts and craft designers were keen to make sure that the workers that were employed had a certain amount of creative control over their own labour and were given opportunities to craft and to carve in a way that was unusual under the context of Victorian capitalism, because under Victorian capitalism, of course, there was designers and then there was mass production. And it's the beginning of that kind of mass production in capitalism. And the arts and craft movement critiqued that. And they also challenged the idea of art as an elite. And they wanted creative activity and the products resulting from creativity to be enjoyed by everyone. And William Morris was well aware that as much as he had these socialist ideals, his market was the Victorian bourgeoisie, and there was only so much he could do within capitalism. But his wonderful book that I recommend reading for everyone is News from Nowhere, where he describes what a future socialist society would look like, and how people are adorned in beautiful clothing. And he describes these kind of ornate communal banqueting halls where social life and creativity blend into one. Now, I suppose, jump forwards quite significantly, we should talk a little bit about these chaps, Dada. So Dada came about out of the chaos and the bloodshed of World War One. It forms around 1916 with Cabaret Voltaire in Zurich in Switzerland. And it's really the first explicitly anti-art movement. So whilst Romanticism and the arts and craft movement contained critiques of art as it existed in the society at the time, Dada was the first movement to really declare the death of art and call for the abolition of art. It was anti quite a lot of things. It was anti-logic, it was anti-rationality, it was anti-manners, and anti any elements of the bourgeois enlightenment or kind of polite bourgeois society. So a famous Dada figure, one of my favourite Dadaists, was a guy called Arthur Crane, and he was known for, amongst other kind of bits of performance art, he would get on a train and hang out in the first class carriages, and he would write these kind of diaries and memoirs about his time, and he used to boast about seducing not just the wife but also the husband of the bourgeoisie. So it's a kind of like a sort of radical anti kind of bourgeois respectability. Another artist at the time was Hugo Ball, and this is him in his tin suit reading his sound poem Caravan. And just as a kind of side piece of trivia, as some of you will know, Lenin met the Dadaists in 1916 and kind of hung out in their circles when he was in exile. The other famous piece of Dada work that will come up is this piece, Duchamp's Fountain, Duchamp's Urinal, which was a kind of deliberately provocative submission to an art board. The idea that this could be something that would be accepted as art at the time was massively controversial. Nowadays, it's kind of accepted that anything, so long as it's put in an art gallery, is accepted as a piece of art. But this was a deliberate provocation. If we then flash forwards into the end of the Second World War, a movement that I've always been interested in is Lecherism. So Lecherism is a kind of precursor to the Situationist International. It started in 1946 when Isidore Aizu, born in Romania, published the Lecherist Manifesto. The kind of central themes of Lecherism is a rejection of traditional forms of art, such as painting and sculpture. The idea that the letter, rather than the word, is the final conveyor of meaning, and the letters could be placed together and manipulated. And the lecturers made these kind of very obscure, slightly weird films where they used letter plus kind of found images, street scenes and bits of Hollywood, coupled with these texts to make these like very, very obscure films. And they were kind of the first people as well to take film and to deliberately scratch it up and bleach it and mark it And in my own arts practice, I've always been influenced by Lutchism, really, and working with Super 8 millimeter film. The Super 8 film is a physical product that can be manipulated and broken up. And this was a precursor to the situationist ideas to do with the spectacle and to do with breaking down the spectacle. So the idea that under capitalism, we're constantly given these spectacles that domineer us in this sublime kind of way, and that the goal of the revolutionary is to detour and subvert the spectacle. A famous Notre Dame, a famous lecturist affair was the Notre Dame affair, which happened in 1950. So this was an intervention where basically the lecturists all got together and they dressed up as Dominican monks and they snuck into Easter Mass and they read a proclamation declaring the downfall of God. And I'm going to read it because I like the text. They got up and they read out, "Today, Easter Day of the Holy Year, here, under the emblem of the Notre Dame of Paris, I accuse the Universal Catholic Church of the lethal diversion of our living strength towards an empty heaven. I accuse the Catholic Church of swindling. I accuse the Catholic Church of infecting the world with its funeral morality, of being the running sore on the decomposed body of the West. Verily, I say unto you, God is dead. We vomit the agonizing insipidity of your prayers, for your prayers have been the greasy smoke over the battlefields of Europe. Go forth, then, into the tragic and exulting desert of a world where God is dead, and till this earth anew with your bare hands, with your proud hands, with your unpraying hands. Today, Easter Day of the Holy Year, here under the emblem of Notre Dame of Paris, we proclaim the death of the Christ God, so that man may live at last." Funnily enough, at the end of this declaration, they were mobbed by the participants in Notre Dame that day, and they were basically saved by the bourgeois police force who came and helped them and got them out and arrested them. And had they not have been arrested, they quite likely would have been severely hurt, if not killed, by an angry mob of devout Christians. So this is then the precursor to Situationism, which is a movement that really emerges in the 1960s. The most famous Situationist work being Guy Debord's Society of the Spectacle. So for Guy Debord, the spectacle represented the domination of media, consumer culture, and passive consumption of active social life. And this critique for Guy Debord also included a critique of art. As Guy Debord said, "All that once directly lived has become mere representation." At the core of Situationism is also this idea of the situation. So they created these kind of spontaneous, authentic moments that would allow people to break away from the spectacle. And one of the things that they did was this idea of psychogeography. So they'd walk around Paris with a tube map of London, for example. Back in my art college days, me and a mate of mine travelled from Dartington in Totnes to London on a late night train and came back at 6 a.m. We just kind of wandered around London aimlessly. And then we came back to our final exhibition and just slept in the art gallery. And it was our kind of attempt to kind of reinvigorate this situationist idea where urban space is something to kind of be wandered amongst and allow us to kind of think about capitalism differently. It's this idea of drifting. At the core of Situationism, of course, is a revolutionary practice, so the idea that we're going to abolish capitalism. And like the Socialist Party of Great Britain, the Situationists were avid, not just avid anti-capitalists, but were also very critical of the Soviet Union, very critical of the French Communist Party at the time that was, as far as they were concerned, was supporting state capitalism. So there's lots of kind of political affiliations that we in the party would make with Situationism. And they were very influential in the Paris uprising of 1968. And that famous kind of Situationist slogan, of course, is "Be realistic, demand the impossible," that was sprayed upon walls. Or the other one was "Beyond the pavement lies the beach," which is a reference to picking up the cobbles to throw it at riot police. But there's a kind of a slightly romantic idea there as well, I think, that behind the kind of urban decay and the spectacle and the domineering nature of capital and capitalist alienation is nature, and an authentic relationship with nature can be strived upon as part of the working class struggle. The other movement that's worth talking about is, I'll just go down a bit. Some Guy Debord, I've skipped a few slides here, but there we go. Metrism, Guy Debord's Society of the Spectacle, Psychogeography. This is Guy Debord's map of Paris, which is a kind of emotional connection of different blocks of streets rather than a kind of practical how to get around Paris map. And yeah, this famous situationist slogan from the 1968 uprising. So let's talk a little bit then about Fluxus, which is another movement that kind of develops in the 1960s in New York at the same time as Situationism is happening in Paris. It was a movement that really aimed to blur the lines between art and everyday life. Artists associated with it were Henry Flint, John Cage, George McInnes, and of course, quite famously, Yoko Ono, who recently had an exhibition on at Tate Modern, for those of you that saw it. Like Dada, it was based on intermedia, so it wanted to combine visual art, performance, theatre, music, and literature in order to blur the boundaries between these different forms of creativity. And like Dada, it was explicitly anti-art. It rejected the formalism and commercialization of the art world, and it rejected the idea of art being an object to be admired in galleries or museums. Instead, they saw art as something that should be integrated into everyday life, questioning the kind of value systems and the commodification of art. And at the core is this participatory and audience interaction. So a core principle was active involvement of the audience in the creation of artwork. Fluxus artists often created these happenings, which happened on the streets of New York, which would involve different kind of performative props. And they would ask the audience to come and join in and use these props in all sorts of ways, whether it was like musical instruments or bicycle wheels or found objects, to create something between art and public life and blur the lines of art and public life. So I suppose it was part of a larger aim to make art more accessible and to break down the divide between art and life. If we now skip to, Yoko Ono here. So this is really like probably one of the most famous pieces of feminist performance art, Yoko Ono's cut piece. So here, members of the audience were invited to come and cut clothing away from her. And it's interesting the kind of form that this artwork took, because towards the end, it became quite violent and quite almost bloody, really. Like, she ended up with cuts on her, and the men in the audience were said to have kind of groped her and ripped her clothes off. But she kind of submitted herself to this work, which is it's a really interesting piece of work. And the relationship between kind of feminism and art would have to be a whole other discussion. But this is obviously really a seminal piece of feminist performance art, in which a woman is the artist and the subject of the art, which kind of critiques, of course, this kind of idea of the woman as the subject of the painter. She's the active embodiment of the work, and it's this kind of interactive piece. 1964. The other piece we could talk about here is Gene Tingley's Homage to New York 1960 destructive sculptural installation, and this is where we get the poster from. So this was a piece of artwork that was designed to self-destruct. The other artist that's associated with auto-destructive art is Gustav Metzger, who made work. His first piece was in 1959, I think I'm right in saying, at the Whitechapel Gallery, where he made a kind of a destructive work that bleached itself out of existence. And this idea of like art as something that could be internally destroyed comes about with the kind of auto-destructives. The other thing I'd like to mention is art strikes and the kind of history of art strikes. So in 1969, the Art Workers Coalition was formed, and it was a strike against MoMA in New York. And this strike was to do with the paying conditions of artists, and it was to do with what they saw as the commercialization of art under MoMA and the kind of official gallery system versus artist creators. The art strike was taken further, really, in the 1980s by people like Stuart Home and the Neoists, who were the first kind of art strikers to not just kind of want to reform art, but actually actively abolish art. And so Stuart Home organized all these strikes in the 80s and 90s that were to do with the destruction of art itself and artists actively refusing to create art in order to undermine what they see as the capitalist productive system. A book I really recommend reading is Stuart Home's Assault on Culture, which gives a really nice timeline of anti-art movements. And it contains Stuart Home's very kind of Marxist critiques of the way in which anti-art itself becomes commodified within capitalism and becomes part of mainstream art. So now let's have a discussion of art under socialism. I think the first thing we should reflect upon is the failure of anti-art. So Duchamp's original urinal was probably chucked out. Nobody knows where the original has gone. But in 1964, he made 12 replicas, and those replicas are currently valued at about 3 million quid each. One of Duchamp's replicas was actually displayed at Tate Modern, and there was all these kind of people who came, including people who were really into the Dada movement, and came and looked at this artwork, but didn't understand the irony of reifying this object when the entire purpose of the work was a kind of fuck you to the art establishment and against the reification of objects. And a friend of mine did quite a nice little intervention there where he went into the toilet cubicles at Tate Modern and he wrote Duchamp's urinal on every urinal that he could see as a kind of critique of this reification that happens where anti-art becomes art, where anti-art becomes another commodity to be sold and exploited under capitalism. The other work we should talk about is Yoko Ono. So Yoko Ono goes from being this kind of street artist, this really quite radical feminist, Marxist critic of the art establishment, to then showing her work in Tate Modern at 20 quid a pop for those that wanted to pay entry, you know, and given that the living wage in London is currently set to about 13 quid, that's about an hour and a half for the average London worker to be able to view this example of radical, anti-capitalist, anti-art. So why should we abolish art, I suppose, is the question, and we should open it up to discussion. There's a few reasons. Art is a hierarchy, with art at the top and other forms of creativity put at the bottom. Other forms of creativity that are put at the bottom include working class craftsmanship and craftswomanship, textile crafts traditionally carried out by women, and indigenous forms of creativity. These are all subserviated to art and high culture. Art reflects a division of labour in which some people get to spend their lives creatively and other people are forced to subserviate their creative selves to the demands of the profit system. In socialism, everyone would have to chip in with everything, including the nasty jobs, and everyone would get to create and to experience their creative selves. Art, including anti-art, is commodified under capitalism. In fact, it's nearly impossible to even imagine art without associating with money and the money system. And even, as I've hopefully demonstrated in this talk, even anti-art eventually comes into the fold of the profit system. Art, as the situation is new, is also a part of the spectacle. It creates this distraction. It subserviates us, particularly sublime art, art that's kind of ethereal, subserviates us in the same way that the church is used to subserviate us. It makes us bow down to this kind of higher power. And it creates this idea of a universal kind of culture, an exploration and discourse, which obscures the class struggle and the nature of class society. In this respect, art, is very similar to religion or nationalism. In socialism, the lines between productive activity, play, socialization, spirituality, sexuality, community gathering, and creativity will be blurred. Thus, when the wages system is abolished, art will be abolished, along with all other forms of division, alienation, and hierarchy. In 1958, the lecturess marched into Notre Dame, declaring the death of God so that humankind could live at last. Today, here in the SPGB headquarters, the political heirs of William Morris and the Arts and Crafts movement declare the death of art so that humankind can live at last. Discussion.